Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. State officials talked about contaminated groundwater near Ann Arbor at a town hall last night. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the 1,4-dioxane plume and what's going to be done about it. But first, it has been over a month now since Governor Snyder and EPA head Gina McCarthy testified before the House Oversight Committee about the Flint water crisis. It was a rough day for the governor. Here's a sampling of what he heard from Pennsylvania Democratic Congressman Dan Cartwright.
And there you are, dripping with guilt, withdrawing your paycheck, hiring lawyers at the expense of the people, and doing your dead-level best to spread accountability to others.
The committee's first hearing about Flint water was back February 3rd, and that's when the Oversight Committee heard from Flint Democratic Congressman Dan Kildee pressing for federal aid for the city as it tries to recover from the water disaster. But has momentum stalled out on Capitol Hill? Congressman Kildee is with us now. And Congressman, I think a lot of people saw or heard those fireworks at those two Oversight Committee hearings and thought, wow, things are going to start moving on the Hill. Did you think that?
Well, I was hopeful, but I have a very good sense of how things work here in Washington. And unfortunately, the Republicans continue to block our efforts to provide relief, despite the fact that at those hearings, Republicans, really in both hearings, were very strong, saying that they blamed the federal government, that they blamed the EPA. Well, I may not share their view on that, at least not to the degree that they feel that the EPA is at fault. But it is quite disingenuous, actually duplicitous, to say at a public hearing on one hand that the EPA was at fault and then not be willing to stand up and say that the federal government has responsibility to fix the problem.
And you got quite busy late last week on Twitter, as well as sending a personal letter to House Speaker Paul Ryan. You tweeted at Speaker Ryan, I'll quote you, "In times of crisis, Congress has acted to help Americans in need." And you wrote, "One of the first votes I cast was for Hurricane Sandy relief. Storm didn't affect my district, but we all acted because Americans were in need." Now, have you gotten any response at all from the Speaker to your tweets or your letter?
Not as of yet, though. I've spoken to the Speaker a couple of times on this issue. And, you know, for him, it seems as though he wants to have the process go through the normal budget process. You know, the problem, of course, with that is that emergencies, crises, disasters don't happen on a schedule. They just happen. And we have a responsibility to act. But even with that, he seemed reluctant to make a commitment that the federal government would provide support. And, you know, in this case, I have avoided at every opportunity to make this any kind of a partisan question. But there's a history here in Washington of Republicans only voting for disaster aid when it affects their district. Then it's a matter of principle. My caucus, Democrats, have stood up no matter where these emergencies take place and have been willing to treat the Americans who are affected by these disasters as fellow Americans. And that's simply all we're asking for here in Congress.
Do you think, is it a case that Congress has kind of moved on? There's Zika virus, there's other things going on, there's the campaign.
We are working very hard to not let that happen. You know, Washington can be, I guess, what you'd call a shiny object town. Whatever the latest shiny object is, it attracts the attention of everyone. But there are certain times where we just have to resist that. I just spoke to all of my Democratic colleagues in the House. We just had a caucus meeting this morning, asking them to stand with me, and they were uniform. They are not going to let this fade away. And so whether it is a piece of legislation that might come out of the Senate, or as we look at the Zika issue or the Puerto Rico issue or the opioid crisis, we're not going to let Flint be left behind. We're going to use every opportunity we can to get help for the people of Flint, despite the fact that it's almost uniform that there's an understanding that the state government is responsible for what happened in Flint, and the state government still has failed to act anywhere equal to the gravity of the problem. A good example is we pressed the state, and they agreed to ask for expanded Medicaid funding in order to get treatment for people in Flint. The president acted very quickly and approved it, but the state legislature has yet to take up their portion of that. I mean, this is something the state asked for that they knew was necessary to help Flint move forward. And the state legislature continues to just sit on it. And I haven't heard a word from the governor asking them to take it up. It just seems to me that at every turn, they're completely tone deaf this is a crisis. This is an emergency. This is not just some issue that they have to deal with sooner or later. There are consequences to their failure to act.
Both Democrats running for president put a lot of focus on Flint leading up to the Michigan primary. There were speeches. There was the debate in Flint the Sunday before the Michigan primary. There are those who feel that that was using Flint to score political points. Do you think that could have hurt Flint's cause in the eyes of the Republicans who control the House and Senate?
Well, I don't know that it hurt their cause because, you know, frankly, there wasn't much indication that they were willing to do anything even before the Michigan primary or the debate that took place in Flint. So they seem to be uniformly just sort of paralyzed, not willing to do anything before or after. In some ways, anytime we have a chance to call attention to this crisis and sort of raise the question of sort of the basic morality of seeing a community facing this problem without this government moving to help, anytime we see that, I think it's helpful. And so I was pleased that the candidates for president raised it, and I'm pleased that from time to time they continue to mention Flint. That helps.
Flint Congressman Dan Kildee. Always great to talk with you, Congressman. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Governor Snyder visited a Flint home on Monday and drank filtered water from the family's tap. And then he announced he'll be drinking filtered tap water from Flint for the next month to show the public it's safe. With us now is Cheryl Canty, the Flint resident who opened up her home to the governor yesterday. Cheryl, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, thank you.
Now, when did you know, Cheryl, that it would actually be the governor calling on you?
I didn't know till about a half hour before he arrived.
What did you think?
Well, I kind of got a little hesitant when I saw a man walk in a suit and an earpiece, like Secret Service. And I was like, why is someone like that here? And then because some other people were coming up to my door, and the news van started rolling up, and I'm like, what's going on? And they came in and asked permission if he could come in.
Boy, oh boy. So he did. And we know that your house has lead and copper service lines, if I'm not mistaken. And for a while, you were using water filters, you were drinking from the tap, and then your lead and copper levels spiked back in March. When did officials advise, what did they advise you to do when those levels spiked?
When the levels spiked about a month ago, they advised us to stop drinking the water, do not consume it in any way because the levels were at toxic levels. So we stopped drinking. It went straight to bottled water for everything.
So what was your understanding about whether water filters were working? Because up until yesterday, as you say, you were using bottled water.
Well, I actually was, as much research as I do, I was not aware that the scientist had recently been working with the filters and recently had a get-together with the governor, including Mark Edwards and the MDEQ and some other groups, and they brought all their data together. This is what the governor told me yesterday. And they realized that these filters, even though they're set at 150 lead, they will take out everything much higher than that. So he said that even if it spikes, it will cover it. He said what it's doing is it will clog faster. It will have to replace the filter more often than normal. But it is appearing to catch the lead.
Well, take us, Cheryl, to your conversation with Governor Snyder. What was that like, and what concerns did you share with him?
Oh, I've had a lot of concerns, actually. I was trying to figure out a way to contact him to where he could actually see a letter I wrote to him, because I have several concerns, especially about my spike, because we don't know where these things are going on, where they're replacing the lead lines. And when they replaced them two blocks up the street from me, I spiked, and that's the one time when we went into toxic levels, and that I am aware of because we were in the Sentinel program, so we had constant monitoring going on. Within a few days of them replacing those lead lines is when my spike happened because I happened to turn in a water sample at that point with the Sentinel program. You know, it just one of problem by problems is we need to know where they're replacing the lines and when they're replacing the lines, because then we can be more aware that we could have spikes going through our lines. And so it's something that I brought up to him yesterday because I'm concerned for the residents in any of the areas where these lines are going. I'm concerned for myself and my family when it does it. The reassurance yesterday that the filters are working at high levels helps, but I still, you know, have to wonder if I wouldn't go to bottled water for a week if they were replacing a lead line up the street from me again.
Well, here you had this rare chance. There's not many people in Flint that have had a chance to sit across the table from Governor Rick Snyder and share what's on their mind. So what kind of feeling did you get? Did you feel as though he listened and really heard you?
I do. I'm so grateful for that opportunity yesterday. It eased my mind on a lot of things. I was able to talk to him about so many things. He asked me a lot of questions regarding my fears, my concerns, things like that, and he intently listened, and he answered all my questions that I had. If he didn't necessarily know the answer, which actually I don't think ever happened during that, he knew the answer to everything that I said. So he's obviously well informed at this point. He had staff here and everybody else, and a scientist, for the water, and they could have jumped in and answered my questions, but they didn't need to. He actually knew the answers. I was really grateful for that.
Did this change your view of Governor Snyder?
I didn't really have a bad view to begin with of Governor Snyder. I really believe that the whole crisis goes back to the MDEQ worker who told our city workers that they didn't need corrosion control. And I told the governor yesterday, I said, if that one line, that one sentence spoken was altered, we would never have had this problem. That's what it comes down to. I'm not a person that's going after everybody. I just want it fixed.
Cheryl Canty is the Flint resident who opened up her home to Governor Snyder yesterday. Cheryl, thanks so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you.
Still to come, we'll look at rumors and hoaxes on Michigan's frontier and how they shaped history. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was a packed house last night at a town hall meeting in Ann Arbor. State DEQ officials were there to talk to residents alarmed about that plume of 1,4-dioxane that's contaminated 3 square miles of groundwater under the city. People want the state to get more assertive with the polluter, Paul Gelman, getting the company to do a better cleanup job to keep that dioxane plume from getting to Ann Arbor's water source, Barton Pond. With us now is State Representative Jeff Irwin. The Ann Arbor Democrat organized last night's town hall meeting. Welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Interim DEQ Director Keith Cray was there. What did he say to worried residents?
Well, this has been going on for a long time, and people in Ann Arbor are pretty frustrated with the stringency and the quality of the cleanup. So I think the first thing that the interim director said was that he understands and identifies with that frustration. He knows this has been going on for a long time. And he was committing the DEQ to take a number of actions to improve the quality of the cleanup.
And what actions did he spell out, especially the ones that seemed to resonate with people?
Well, first and foremost, the DEQ has recently announced that they are making our cleanup rules, our cleanup criteria, more stringent for this chemical, 1,4-dioxane. The current standard is 85 parts per million. That's what the state is saying is safe for drinking water and for human contact. But we've learned from newer science that that's not safe. And so the state has responded to that. And they have announced that they're lowering the standard to 7.2 parts per billion, which is a huge improvement from 85 parts per billion. So that was one of his big announcements. And he also said that the department was going to start acting on the site as if the new standard was already in place, because it does take about 6 months for these standards to be fully approved through the whole process. But what that means is that for residents who might have wells that are below the old standard but above the new standard, we're going to be identifying those individuals and providing clean water to them and hooking them up to municipal water. It means there's going to be more monitoring activities, more wells going in the ground to characterize the plume and make sure it's not moving towards Ann Arbor's water supply. They're going to develop a new and updated contingency plan that will put in place some solid triggers for if the water does start moving towards the drinking water supply, what actions need to take place on behalf of the company and the state regulatory body. So there's a number of things. He also agreed to work on more transparency. One of the big struggles with the site is that we've got a number of local activists and professors and people who care about clean water in Ann Arbor who've been watching this plume for years and years and years. For instance, there's a group called SIO Residents for Safe Water, srsw.org. And when I got elected to county commissioner in 1999, one of the first reports I heard was from Roger Rail with that organization. What they've done that they've taken all the well logs, all the information, and they've pored over them to produce reports on exactly what's happening underground. And that's been invaluable to the efforts because the DEQ just simply doesn't have the manpower and the expertise to pay that much attention to each individual site. So we've been asking for more data and more transparency, and the DEQ is committed to provide that as well.
And with the state saying, yes, we are going to, you know, tighten up those dioxane standards, as you say, that's a huge jump from 85 parts per billion to 7.2. Will that give enough muscle to force the company, Paul Gelman, to do a better job of cleaning up?
Yeah, there's a couple of pieces to that. One is that the Paul Corporation, which bought the initial responsible parties corporation, Gelman Life Sciences, they've recently been bought by an even larger multinational company called Danaher, which has significant resources and expertise in water filtration. We're hoping that that expertise can be brought to bear to improve the quality of the cleanup. The one complicating factor here is that this is one of a couple sites in the state that is governed by a court order. So the cleanup is stipulated by a court judgment. And what this new standard is going to allow, it's going to allow DEQ and State Attorney General's office to go back into court and argue for an amendment to that cleanup plan. And so this is really the first step, but it's a big necessary step to get us back into court and to argue that this company that's responsible for polluting a vast geography underneath Washtenaw County, that that company should be held responsible and that they should have to do more to get that pollution out of the ground.
Representative, do you think there is the will in the State Attorney General's office to do this?
Well, I hope so. And the state attorney general sent a representative to the meeting last night. She was there and listened. They've also committed to start attending some of the local meetings of a group called CARD, the Coalition on Action to Remediate Dioxane. And they've been doing that. And so they are taking a greater interest in the subject. And we think that armed with the expertise that our local experts and activists have, that they'll be more successful in court than they were last round.
I'm wondering, is there anything new to report on efforts to get the EPA to designate this as a Superfund cleanup site?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that lately. Like I said, the frustration is high in Ann Arbor. Folks feel that this pollution has essentially been allowed to just spread and that the state really has not been tough enough on the company to make them clean up the mess that they made. I would agree with that. So as a result of that, there are many folks who are frustrated to the extent that they want to call an EPA to make this a Superfund site and get a different group of regulators on the task. You know, personally, as a state representative, I think my responsibility is to keep working with the State Department to try to get the most that we can out of them for clean water and public health protection in Ann Arbor. And so that's my focus.
State Representative Jeff Irwin, Democrat from Ann Arbor, thanks for bringing us up to date on last night's town hall about the dioxane plume. Appreciate your time.
Appreciate your time. Thanks.
The rumor mill is certainly thriving in the 21st century, fueled by the internet and social media. But roll the clock back, way back, to the 1600s, the 1700s. And even without the help of Facebook or Twitter, rumors spread quickly in early America. They may have been groundless, but those rumors took root and impacted many important issues of the day, including whether or not to go to war. University of Michigan history and American culture professor Gregory Evans Dowd explores all of this in his new book, Groundless: Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Thanks for being with us. Now, how do you differentiate a rumor from a legend from a hoax?
All right, let's go backwards. A hoax is certainly deliberate. It has a deliberate origin. Somebody creates it, disseminates it, wants to shape events. A rumor can begin with a hoax. A rumor can have its origins in deliberate misinformation, which is what a hoax is. But rumors also often arise independent of an individual author. They sometimes arise in the collective imagination. They form as people are trying to figure out what's going on in ambiguous circumstances.
And often frightening circumstances.
Frightening really helps with the ambiguity and with the determination to create a rumor.
And probably the speed in which it spreads.
Exactly. So Rumors can definitely begin with hoaxes, but they also, sometimes we really don't know where they begin. And that's their very nature. The very nature of a rumor is that we don't know its origin. So in my work, I do discuss a hoax that began with Benjamin Franklin, for instance. He deliberately obscured his authorship. He understood media as well as anybody else in his age. Mm-hmm. He deliberately obscured his authorship. He circulated this saying, oh, I don't really know where this came from.
And what was it that he was circulating?
Well, it was a rather horrific story about British officers rewarding Indians for bales of scalps taken on the frontier. So massive quantities of scalps packaged, sent to the British and being rewarded, the Indians being rewarded for mm-hmm. taking these. And this was completely came out of his rather thinning head. But he was smart enough to conceal his authorship as he circulated. So the point is that a rumor is of uncertain origin. That's why I titled mm-hmm. the work Groundless.
Groundless. And then legends.
So a legend is also groundless, like a rumor. A legend is generally passed on from generation to generation. It is it's historical in nature. It's usually a story about the past that's passed on from generation to generation. But like a rumor, it has uncertain origin. And the two phenomena, rumor and legend, overlap. You have rumors that also are passed on seemingly from generation to generation. They're always about something that's taking place now.
Interesting.
But they resemble very much similar stories or almost identical stories that were told in the past.
Can you give us an example of one that we might have heard of today that you could say, you know what, they were saying that back in the 1700s, 1800s?
Well, certainly rumors involving other religions are repeated over and over again. Probably some of the most enduring rumors in Western culture would be rumors that are anti-Semitic in nature. Mm. But one rumor that I deal with in the book that does circulate today, I think it has its origins in probably the 19th century, is the rumor about the smallpox blanket. And that's a rumor that's told certainly not only in among American Indians, but also among Anglo-Americans.
And this is the one where they say that that the tribes were deliberately given blankets infected
with smallpox. And they and it did happen once that we know of. I mean, it is documented.
So there's a little grain of truth there.
There's a grain of truth, mm-hmm. and that's the case with many rumors. In 1763, British officers did discuss and actually did pass out.
Early germ warfare.
Early germ warfare, indeed.
Wow. When I think about this, it seems very clear from your book, everybody was fueling this rumor mill back on in the early days.
It's human nature.
Absolutely. Native Americans had theirs. British soldiers had ones. Was it something about eyes being gouged out?
Exactly. Eye gouging was is thought to be an American practice on the frontier, but this particular eye gouging, took place in Concord, Massachusetts, which was not exactly the frontier at the Battle of Lexington and Concord.
But
in
they all serve a purpose. Because you talk about what Ben Franklin, he circulates this, so it all serves a purpose to coalesce you against.
Yeah,
fill in the blank.
It could be a part of what's sometimes called othering or mm-hmm. prejudice. In the case of the British at the time, they saw the Americans as savages and identified these Americans as being similar to Native Americans, who they had also recently fought.
We saw that in World War II when civilians in Okinawa were told by the Japanese that the Americans were going to do awful things to them, and you saw those people jumping to their deaths over a cliff because of the fear of the rumor that had been circulated by the Japanese.
So, yes, these things are rife through history.
I'm talking with University of Michigan history and American culture professor Gregory Evans Dowd. His book is Groundless, Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Take us into this one very famous early American rumor. It happened in Michigan, and it was about Henry Schoolcraft.
Henry Schoolcraft one day was given a newspaper by a friend in Washington, D.C., and he read his own obituary. He read that he had been murdered at Sault Ste. Marie. He actually hadn't been to Sault Ste. Marie he hadn't been there since 1841. But the rumor had it that he had been murdered by what was termed a man who was termed a mixed blood. Actually, he was termed a half-breed, mm-hmm. John Tanner. John Tanner, who had no Indian ancestry, John Tanner, who was a so-called white Indian, that is a boy captured at the age of 9, taken up into Michigan, who lived, was adopted by a woman whom he remembered quite generously, Netnokwa, and he spent his late childhood, teens, early adulthood, really until he was about 40 years old, among Ottawas and Ojibwas in northern Michigan and west of Lake Superior.
So he was identified as a supposed murderer.
He was identified as the murderer of, well, in the initial rumor, Henry Schoolcraft. That was soon corrected. Henry Schoolcraft was reading his own obituary, knew he hadn't been murdered. He was in Washington, D.C. And but he surmised that there might be a nugget of truth in this rumor. And that nugget of truth turned out to be true. It was that his younger brother, James Schoolcraft, had been shot dead.
And what was the political climate? Did this serve some kind of purpose to stir things up?
Well, I think so. There really is very little evidence that John Tanner shot Henry Schoolcraft. John Tanner disappeared around the time of the murder. That might be some evidence. But John Tanner was a 66-year-old man. He had been disabled in a series of accidents. The shooting apparently took place in broad daylight. People claim to have heard the shot and seen the smoke. And yet this disabled 66-year-old man supposedly escaped with many young, skilled Ojibwas and Anglo-Americans in hot pursuit. It's rather difficult to believe.
And at the same time, there was quite a growing movement in Michigan to push the Ottawas and the Ojibwas out of the state.
There was.
Yes.
And Henry Schoolcraft had long been an advocate, oddly enough, and I say oddly enough because his wife was of Indian descent, but he had long been an advocate for Indian removal. He had frequently said, oddly enough again, that Indians and whites cannot live side by side. And so he was, he pushed removal. And I think that his belief in Tanner's guilt had, and his firm belief, even when other evidence surfaced that perhaps someone else had done it, his own brother-in-law thought someone else had done it, he was so convinced that Indians and whites could not live side by side that he saw in John Tanner a man who had been contaminated by long life among the Indians.
So proof positive. This is what I believe, and John Tanner proves it. Interesting. You use the phrase "rumoring with a vengeance" in
yes.
your book. What do you mean by that?
Well, it was a turn of phrase meant to describe an Anglo-American sense that at the time, Native Americans were characterized, particularly in warfare, by vengeance, by revenge, that the main motive in war was revenge. Now, this is rather extraordinary if you actually think about it. People go to war for all kinds of reasons. Revenge might be a reason, but that it's the reason was extremely popular among Anglo-Americans at the time. And
let them off the hook
yeah.
of what was going on.
Well, exactly. But what's actually kind of peculiar about it is if you think about what Native Americans might have reason to be vengeful for when it comes to Anglo-America, dispossession,
thrown off
a considerable
lands.
Amount of violence.
Yes.
And these people in the 19th century did have a sense of that. They had a sense that they had been responsible for ill deeds against Native Americans. And so this was also part of the urge for removal. I mean, the sense that we really can't live side by side because these people have a grievance against us.
Interesting. University of Michigan History and American Culture Professor Gregory Evans Dowd, his book, Groundless: Rumors, Legends, and Hoaxes on the American Frontier. Great talking with you. Thank you.
I am delighted. Thank you so much.
And we always want to hear from you. What stories are you focusing on or issues that you want to hear more about? It's easy to let us know. Find us on Facebook, search for Stateside. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio and MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. Coming up, we'll hear about the potential impact of the Gordie Howe International Bridge on the Southwest Detroit neighborhood of Delray.
You cannot put a price on this. You cannot put a price on family. I can look across the street and I see my mom. I can look the other way to my son.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All week long, Stateside is joining with other NPR programs around the country exploring trade issues. Certainly, once it's built and running, the Gordie Howe International Bridge from Windsor to Detroit will be one of Michigan's most important tools for international trade. It's projected truck traffic will double from the current 10,000 trucks a day to some 20,000 trucks every day rumbling through Southwest Detroit, the neighborhood of Delray. So what is good for Michigan trade, not to mention America's and Canada's trade, is going to be felt deeply by the people who live in that neighborhood. Simone Sagovac is with us. She's project director for the Southwest Detroit Community Benefits Coalition. Simone, welcome to Stateside.
Good afternoon.
And also with us is one of the Delray residents who will be affected by the Gordie Howe Bridge. Selena Carrion is the mother of seven children. Hello, Selena, and thanks so much for being with us.
Not a problem. Good afternoon.
Selena, you've lived in Delray since you were about 12 years old. You own a home. You're raising your family. Tell us what this neighborhood is like.
The neighborhood, as I know it, is very, very connected. Everyone knows each other. Everyone's related. It's a family. The community, as I've known it over the years, has started to deplete. People are leaving. So it's not as big a community as it used to be, but it's still our community, and it's like a family.
And Simone, you were telling me how, even though much of Michigan may not have heard about the impending arrival of this bridge, this is something that the people of Delray have been hearing about, and it's been swirling around you since 2001?
2001, and it's hard to imagine, but for many people, there were children who grew up their entire lives from kindergarten, they're graduating, they're, you know, heading to college now, while their families have been wrestling with the decisions that they have to make about what is going to happen for their future.
What do both of you think about the bridge in general?
Well, the bridge is something that may be a necessity for our trade. I think that any development project really needs to be considering how it's placed in the communities where it's located. The bridge may bring all kinds of development, other developments that will come because of the bridge. It may bring jobs that people have been waiting for. People talked about wanting to walk to work again. And so when this bridge project first came up, there were people in the community who, of course, were always afraid of what is it going to mean for me. Some of those people thought, maybe we'll actually see jobs. Maybe there will be a revival here of activity. And of course, it's been a very long road for the community.
And we'll let you pick up, Selena, your thoughts about the bridge.
I actually support a bridge that comes with community benefits. I think it's a good thing for our overall economy. It'll boost the economy, improve our infrastructure, and increase our exporting, which we would like, right, and give us easier access to international ports. So I think with all that said, what that would do with this new bridge would create new jobs, grow companies, attract new businesses, and hopefully secure a middle class. That's why I support it, but I support it with community benefits.
Because there's the consideration of the price that you and your neighbors in Delray are going to pay that no one else is going to have to pay as the bridge is built. And then you have these starting with 5,000 a day, and we hear it could even go up much higher as far as these trucks. What do you fear as far as the day-to-day impact that all of this could have on your quality of life and on your health?
Well, quality of health, I worry about because I do have seven children, and we will have this increased truck traffic that will come through. Not only that, with trading, you'll have the trains that'll continue to come through. My concern is not only health, but also the noise impacts and connectivity.
And I know, Simone Sagovac, as you're working with the Southwest Detroit Community Benefits Coalition, you're trying to be the voice of the community in all of this planning. What kind of concerns are you expressing? And I'm wondering, to whom? Who are you talking to, and what are you being told?
One of the big concerns is for the residents who will be stranded essentially by the project, left around the infrastructure, who aren't going to be bought out. And as people learn more and more about how close they're going to be living to where the I-75 service drive will be expanded, they're going to be buying a few houses off of that service drive, but the service drive will expand. And so people who right now don't live on the service drive essentially will be. There isn't a separation between these land uses, residential and the transportation. I mean, that's a problem everywhere near highways, but it's a densely populated community. In fact, on the north side of the community there, it's the most densely populated in the city of Detroit, with the highest number of children per family. So we are concerned about those health impacts. And we've been talking, you ask who we're talking with, we've been talking for years. It started with MDOT. And then when the 2012 U.S.-Canada agreement was signed, it included door opener language for community benefits to be provided as part of the bidding process for this bridge. That led to us having conversations with now what is the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority. And we have a community advisory group that meets with the Windsor-Detroit Bridge Authority, and we have submitted requests for the community benefits that the community would like to see.
What kind of community benefits when you say, here's what we want?
Things like offering optional buyouts for people who are going to be stranded, providing that kind of green space and other amenable infrastructure for the community. For example, we'd like to see a better connected community to the riverfront. Residents want to be connected to each other and to the park system that's there. Possibly seeing there be some broader recreational cross-border development that happens. But at the ground level of the community, residents really want to make sure that it works for them, that there is truck routing that is going to be away from impacting their families, making sure that residents have the opportunity to access the jobs that are created from the bridge, that they would be receiving training opportunities to access those jobs. So the main areas of community benefits typically are for environmental protections, that there be mitigations. With this project, especially since the main impacts are coming from the thousands of trucks and the diesel emissions, we're looking for programs to reduce diesel emissions in the trucks.
And these are things that have been done elsewhere, so you know they could work.
They absolutely have been done elsewhere. We always point to the ports of Los Angeles, Long Beach, where they successfully implemented a diesel truck mitigation program. It's also a big public-private project. There are always differences, but it shows that there are opportunities, and we can be talking about different ways to bring those opportunities to the Detroit area, where we are going to be a trade hub. We already are, but we're going to be a growing trade hub. And it's well documented across the country what the impacts are of residents who live in these trade zones, where the diesel emissions is high from the intermodal activity, not just the trucks, but the intermodal, the rail activity, and the boats that come by.
Selina Carrion, do you and your neighbors worry that you're going to have to move?
I do worry. I didn't. Years ago, I wasn't so much worried about that because when I originally bought the house, I planned to live there forever. You know, it's a good place for me to live. I have 7 children. I didn't expect to ever have to worry about paying rent somewhere or obtaining like a mortgage payment. I never expected to have to worry about those things. I thought I secured that by purchasing a home outright. But now I worry that that's something that's coming down the line, that I'll eventually be either forced out because they won't make a decision, or I'll just be bought out and then have to relocate my family. And you cannot put a price on this. You cannot put a price on family. I can look across the street and I see my mom. I can look the other way, my son, and behind me, my brother-in-law, my sister-in-law down the street. My family is all there. You cannot put a price on that. So how will I ever get that back? So yeah, that's a great concern of mine, having to move or relocate or be pushed out.
Or be pushed out. And Simone Sagovec, as Selina and other neighbors in Dilray are wrestling with this, you're having a hard time getting a real concrete answer about what to expect?
That's true. The process for the remaining companies now that will be bidding to build the bridge is a highly protected bidding process. And so we won't know what's actually included, what the bridge developer, the successful bridge developer who's selected, we won't know until they're selected, until they enter a contract, what will actually be provided in the way of community benefits. We are having ongoing discussions. We know that Canada and Michigan agree that this project should be built well on both sides of the border. We look to what has happened on the Canadian side so far with the Herb Gray Parkway, how they've included buffering distances that's considered in the design of the project. They've got green park space over the top. That's much longer distance that they had to build that connector road to the Highway 401, but the design of it is very friendly to the communities and to the residents around it. And we're looking for that same kind of thing on this side of the border.
We've seen in the past in Flint, we've seen certainly the Black Bottom neighborhood in Detroit that vanish and sacrificed on the altar of progress, whether it's building a freeway, whatever, for redevelopment. Do you fear that that's going to happen to Delray?
I think the signs are there that it's very likely to happen. We don't know what will happen, though, once the bridge is built. There will be some cleanup of industrial sites that have been left abandoned for years. That's a positive. But for the remaining residential area, which, as Selena said, has become depleted, it's a challenge that we are now having conversations with the city of Detroit about how do we continue services? How do we continue to make it a livable community for the remaining residents while we know that there's going to be a higher and increasing level of interest for transportation and trade-related activities to also locate near the bridge. And so what do we do with that? We know that the city is looking at areas all across its boundaries, and where there's been decline in residential population, those services are sort of slated in the long term to not provide for residents anymore. So we need a phased plan for this community, which will acknowledge the hardships that people have already been having for so long, and how we provide amenities that anybody wants. You want park near you. You want a place for your kids to play. You want it to be safe. You don't want there to be illegal dumping continuously, so you need security measures happening. These are the basics that really any community wants, and we're saying with this project, with the services that this project is going to provide to the state of Michigan and well beyond, just like the other industries that are hosted in this community, the impacts of those industries are borne on the people who live there. And many across the state don't actually realize what that's like in a community like this. How most people like their communities, that's how people in Delray would like their community.
Simone Sagovec is the project director for the Southwest Detroit Community Benefits Coalition. And we've been talking with Selena Carrion, who is a lifelong Delray resident. Thank you so much to both of you for giving voice to the concerns of the neighbors in Delray.
Thank you.
Thank you.
People living in rural and suburban areas of our state have long been warned of the dangers to pets and children from coyotes. Over the past decade, the coyotes made its way into all 83 counties in Michigan. Lately, there is talk of sightings of a rare coyote-wolf hybrid called, not too surprisingly, the coy wolf. With us now is Kevin Swanson. He's the DNR Wildlife Management Specialist with the Bear and Wolf Program. Good to have you with us, Kevin.
Thank you, Cindy.
We got to start out just talking terminology. You're saying there's really no species known as, well, I'm doing air quotes here, as a coy wolf, correct?
There is not. No, there's been a lot of research done, and the scientific community agrees that, you know, there's no new species known as a coy wolf. Of course, we have gray wolves in Michigan in the Upper Peninsula, and we've had a few confirmations of gray wolves in the northern Lower Peninsula, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And we have coyotes throughout the state, but no species known as a coy wolf. One thing to keep in mind that coyotes are actually, they're difficult to judge with regards to their size, especially during winter months when their coats and guard hairs are longer. They appear to be much larger than they actually are. So we get a lot of pictures that are submitted to us from residents throughout the state of Michigan that believe these pictures are that of a wolf or what they call a coy wolf. And actually, it's just a coyote, but they're just much more fuller looking and larger looking in the winter months.
Okay, and then they kind of slim down as the warm weather comes.
Right, right.
So this is what, an interspecies mating of a wolf with a western coyote? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, if we go back in time, and I'm not a geneticist, mm-hmm. as I said, but if we go back in time, much of the research suggests that this hybridization, if it occurred, it was long ago, between 50 and 100 years ago, when wolf numbers in the Great Lakes states and elsewhere were at all-time lows. So the only time normally that you have any sort of hybridization is at the leading edge of a population expansion. So when wolves are at their lowest point, when it was difficult for them to find a mate, at that time it looks like there was some hybridization with coyotes because there was no other option. Now moving to today, if you look at the gray wolf population in the Upper Peninsula, now we're undergoing our survey right now, and we'll have a new estimate quite soon. But today, a wolf would kill a coyote rather than mate with it in the Upper Peninsula because there's enough wolves. We have a viable population, so there is no interbreeding going on between those two species. There's more conflict where wolves would very readily kill coyotes if the opportunity arises, just because they're considered to be a threat to the wolf's territory.
Okay, so there we are. So if indeed there are these hybrid coy wolves, they are the descendants of something that happened decades ago.
That's right. An example of that would be the three canids in 2010 that were trapped and collared in Sheboygan County, I believe it was, in the northern Lower Peninsula. When the wildlife researchers trapped those animals, they very much appeared phenotypically to be wolves. They had dentition and size that were more typical of wolves than coyotes. So they looked larger, which is very confusing. And that's why we have to rely on genetic testing to ascertain that for sure. And those animals turned out to be coyotes, not wolves. They were coyotes, but there was the genetic testing showed that there was some maternal introgression long ago somewhere in their pedigree, which makes them larger looking coyotes. But there's no species known as a coy wolf. Those were coyotes, but they had some introgression of wolves in their genes long ago. We either have coyotes or we have wolves, or you might have coyotes that have had some hybridization but long ago in their pedigree. So there's no species known as coy wolves. That's what I'm trying to make clear.
Yes.
There's no new species. Now, if you consider now that we have confirmed in 2004 and then again in 2014, we have confirmed wolves in the northern Lower Peninsula. If there's only a male there, let's say there was a male and a female, and the female somehow died or was hit by a car or something, and there was just a male there, if that male found coyotes, then I guess the possibility exists that there would be some sort of hybridization.
I'm interested how the DNR treats wolves and coyotes in terms of management and regulation.
Well, we have a liberal season on coyotes throughout the state of Michigan. They're a game species. You know, they provide very good trapping and hunting opportunities throughout the state. Wolves, of course, are now back on the federal list of endangered species. The Michigan DNR and other agencies, as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, disagree with that ruling. Wolves have made a wonderful comeback here in Michigan. We've got over 600 wolves in 2014. That was our last count, was 636. That's a minimum estimate. As I mentioned earlier, we're doing that survey again now. So there is no management of wolves in Michigan right now because they are federally endangered. And that really ties our hands with regard to management, because right now, even if a livestock rancher had a wolf kill his or her livestock, or if a hunter had a wolf come in and kill a dog, they're not able to kill that animal. The only time we can kill a wolf in Michigan right now is if there's an imminent threat to human life.
Kind of circling back to this hybridization that seems to perhaps have happened decades ago, it certainly does seem like it's very much lots of coyote and very little wolf.
Yeah, some studies show that there's very, very little wolf introgression in those coyotes. And if you go look way back, there's dog characteristics too, if you go way, way back. And that's where it becomes genetically, it's pretty hard to understand. And there's disagreement even within the scientific community about that. But I haven't heard of any notable researchers saying that we have a new species called a coy wolf. It's just not true.
Fair enough. Kevin Swanson is the DNR Wildlife Management Specialist with the Bear and Wolf Program. Kevin, thanks so much for talking with us and making us think of all the things that are happening in Michigan's woods and beyond, because we know those coyotes are ranging all over the state.
Yes, they are. Thank you, Cindy.
Great talking with you, Kevin. Thank
you. All right. Bye-bye.
Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Cass Adair, Mike Blank, Ryan Grimes, Sean McHenry, Mercedes Mejia, and Lindsay Scullin. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.